Is Dennis McKenna, Dr. Dennis McKenna, the brother of Terrence McKenna, the late Terrence McKenna, who was on this program many times, was a good friend. Terrence, God bless him, is gone now, and I'm so sorry. He was such a great man. He was such a great mind. But you're about to have a strange journey yourself, because his brother Dennis, he almost, frankly, he sounds like a clone, but I'll let you decide for yourself. Last hour, we talked with Richard C. Hoagland. We've got a link up on the website right now to the John Glenn statement made on Frasier, or at least a sort of a little part of it. You can see that little part right now by going to my website at www.artbell.com. Everybody's taking a look at that one. NBC posted it, put it up there. It's actual video with the audio and only a partial statement. And then just to sort of wrap that up, Ann in Albuquerque, New Mexico writes, "Hey, Art, is it possible that Richard C. could be the Antichrist?" Yeah, I thought about that. Sure, it's possible. Now, Dennis McKenna, who sent me the following bio on himself, I'm going to try and read this. No guarantees. For the last 25 years, Dennis McKenna has pursued the interdisciplinary study of ethnopharmacologically pharmacology and plant hallucinogens. He is co-author, of course, with his brother Terrence, of The Invisible Landscape, Mind Hallucinogens, and The I Ching, Seabury Press, 1975, Citadel Press, 91, a philosophical and metaphysical exploration of the ontological implications of psychedelic drugs, which resulted from the two brothers' early investigations of the Amazonian hallucinogens in 1971. He received his doctorate in 1984 from the University of Columbia. His doctoral research focused on anthropopharmacological investigations of the botany, chemistry, and pharmacology of Akuza and Ukubi, two orally active, I believe it's tryptamine-based hallucinogens used by indigenous peoples of the northwest Amazon. Following the completion of his doctorate, Dr. McKenna received postdoctoral research fellowships in the laboratory of Clinical Pharmacology, National Institute of Mental Health, and the Department of Neurology, Stanford University School of Medicine. In 1990, he joined Shaman Pharma. Dennis?
Yes.
He joined Shaman what?
Pharmaceuticals.
Pharmaceuticals, as director of
Ethnopharmacology.
Thank you. You're going to help me right through this. Then went back to Minnesota, I guess, in 1993 to join the Aveda Corporation.
Right.
Manufacturer of a natural cosmetics product as senior research pharmacologist.
Cognosist.
You want to read the rest of this?
No.
he currently works as a scientific consultant to clients in the herbal, nutritional, and pharmaceutical industries. Together with two colleagues in the natural products industry, he incorporated the Nonprofit Institute for Natural Products Research, or INPR, in October of 98 to promote research and scientific education with respect to botanical medicines and other natural medicines. He is currently senior lecturer at the Center for Spirituality and Healing, that's interesting, in the Academic Health Center at the University of Minnesota. Dr. McKenna serves on the advisory board of the American Botanical Council and on the editorial board of Dennis?
Phytomedicine.
Thank you. International Journal of
Phytotherapy and Phytopharmacology.
Wonderful. Founding board member and vice president of the Hefter. Hefter.
Not to be confused with Hefner.
I understand. Okay, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to the investigation of therapeutic applications for psychedelic plants and compounds. He's also served as board member and research advisor to Botanical Dimensions, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the investigation of
ethnomedically
significant plants. He was a primary organizer and key scientific collaborator for the
WASCA
project, an international biomedical study of
WASCA,
a psychoactive drink used in ritual context by indigenous peoples and
syncretic
religious groups in Brazil. He has conducted extensive
ethnobotanical
field work in the Peruvian, Colombian, and Brazilian Amazon. He has served as invited speaker at numerous scientific congresses, seminars, and symposia. Dr. McKenna's author or co-author of over 35 scientific papers in peer-reviewed journals. His publications have appeared in the Journal of...
Ethnopharmacology.
European Journal of Pharmacology, Brain Research, Journal of Neuroscience, Journal of Neurochemistry, Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, Economic Botany, and elsewhere. My God almighty, Dennis. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Art. It's great to be here.
And thank you for the help.
Am I on the air?
Of course you're on the air.
All right.
Yes, you're on the air. And it's like listening to Terrence to hear your voice. I was so shocked when I called you and we talked on the phone. I just sat there kind of blown away. Just blown away.
Yes, well, everyone says we sound the same, especially on the telephone.
Oh, and here on the air, believe me, you sound the same. Now, when you and I talked on the phone, putting all of this simply, you said that you were more into the science of drugs, while your brother Terrence was, my words, probably more hand-to-mouth.
Well, yeah, we sort of have a division of labor, I guess. You could call it. He was more interested in the philosophical and metaphysical side, and I was more interested in what you might call the nuts and bolts side, although...
So in other words, when you would, for
obviously,
example...
Obviously, there was a lot of overlap of those two things.
So, for example, when you would discover a new drug, you'd say, here, take this, Terrence.
Not exactly.
Or Terrence said, hey, what you got there? I'll take that.
I just got curious about how these things work. And, you know, those of your listeners that are familiar with our experiences in the Amazon and have read The Invisible Landscape will know that we came up against a number of things down there that it's very hard for science to get its hands around.
Explain. No, I actually, you know what? I have never really heard the story of what happened in the Amazon.
So. Well, I don't know if we can go into it here. It's kind of a long story.
Maybe the high points.
Well, those of you who've read my brother's book, True Hallucinations, will be familiar with it. I would like to say, Art, before we get into that, I'd like to say that I very much appreciate the support that has come. It's been a rough couple of years here.
I know, horrible, actually.
And I very much appreciate the support that came from many of your listeners. There's really no way to so many people, but while we were struggling with Terrence's illness and his family, you know, we always knew that we weren't alone, that many people
never
loved Terrence so much, and we could feel that support.
Terrence had a brain tumor, for those who don't know, and, you know, Dennis, I interviewed Terrence very much toward the end.
Right.
And his he was so good with it. His philosophical approach to the possibility that he might die was incredible. I had him on the air, and he talked about it. He talked about it, and boy, did he have it together.
Yes, he had it together. He had it together, and as he said in a couple of interviews, you know, if the use of these plants and working with these demonic states doesn't prepare you for what lies beyond, I don't know what does. And I think that's true. I think that, you know, a lot of his experiences in life, you know, led up to that. So there were no real surprises. And, you know, in the latter stages, he was very much ready to take control of the starship and let it take him where it would. But I did want to you know, express my gratitude to so many of your listeners that were, you know, part of that struggle.
Well, I had Terrence on many times, and the audience knew him as one of their own, so it could
that's
not
right.
have been any other way.
That's right.
He was absolutely, Dennis, a remarkable, one of the most remarkable men I've ever had the pleasure to know. So I guess that's pretty good as remembrances go. One
right.
of the most remarkable people I've ever known. God, what a mind he had.
Yes, he had a great mind. As a remarkable person, and in ways that, you know, the world is a poorer place without him. And I'm very lucky to have had, you know, to have grown up with him. I mean, he was obviously a great influence on me and on many people.
Well, anyway, the two of you did go to the Amazon, and he never really talked a lot about that. We touched on it, but he never really talked a lot about the nuts and bolts of what actually went on down there.
Well, I guess, you know, how to get into this story, you know,
why did you go down? What made you go down there?
Well, we both grew up in the 60s, of course, and I guess you could say we were hippies during the, you know, that period of foment in the United States. And, you know, I was in Haight-Ashbury in 67, and Terrence was living in Berkeley, and so we were interested. We were interested in psychedelics, you know, and in an experimental phase of those with our lives. But the one that stuck out in our experience at that time was one that that still is fairly rare, and that is DMT, which stands for dimethyltryptamine. Back in the 60s, it used to be called the businessman's trip because it's so short. The way in duration, the way that DMT is normally taken, pure synthetic DMT, is essentially you smoke the free base as you do crack. And when you do that, it produces a very rapid but extremely intense psychedelic experience, which lasts about 10 minutes.
Terrence had a quote about that experience that he used to say. He compared it, I'm trying to remember what he compared it to, but he had a
roller coaster ride, or perhaps a rocket ship ride.
Well, something about, a rocket ship ride, but he said it was probably the closest thing to heaven on earth, or something fairly significant like that.
Well, I don't know if it's exactly heaven on earth, because it can be quite terrifying. I mean, it's very overwhelming, you know, in that form. And it's also sort of very hard to pull anything out of it. It's such a profound and such a rapid experience that you come back not really able to English much that you experienced. I mean, about all you can say is, my God, what happened? And that was part of our, and that was at least the exoteric motivation for going to the Amazon, because we had heard in a paper by an ethnobotanist, Ari Schultes, about a very obscure hallucinogen used by the Witoto in the Northwest Amazon. This was called Ukue in their language, and it was a DMT-containing sap or resin from a tree.
Uh-huh.
But what was unusual about it, and what's unusual about pharmacology of DMT to a certain extent, is that DMT is not orally active. If you eat it, pure DMT, nothing happens.
Because you have to smoke it.
You have to smoke it in the synthetic form, because it's inactivated by enzymes in your gut and in your liver called monoamine oxidase.
So it's got to go straight from the lungs to the bloodstream.
Right, or somehow bypass that system. Now, in the case of ayahuasca, which is the other beverage, the psychoactive beverage that forms the linchpin of Amazonian shamanism, and has been sort of my preoccupation for 30 years, they get around this by combining two plants. They combine the leaves of one plant, which they call chacruna, with the bark of a vine, which they call ayahuasca, and the beverage itself is called ayahuasca. The bark contains compounds which are monoamine oxidase inhibitors, and when combined with the leaves of the chacruna, which contain DMT, that protects the DMT from digging by this monoamine oxidase.
So now you can drink
enzyme
it.
System. So now it becomes orally active. Exactly. But it becomes a very different experience. Instead of lasting 10 minutes, it lasts more like 3 or 4 hours.
Oh, my.
And the but the intensity is less. So, you know, it's like the slowed down, it's like you're seeing it at normal speed, and when you smoke it, you're seeing it on the fast forward.
Dennis, I have no frame of reference to know what this what this combination of drugs is like. Is it like LSD? Is it a lesser experience?
No, I wouldn't say it's a lesser experience. It's a different experience than LSD.
If you compare intensity levels.
It's always related to dose. I mean, ayahuasca can be extremely intense. It's similar to mushrooms, and it's similar chemically and pharmacologically to mushrooms, because that is, I mean, psilocybin and DMT are
mescaline
in the same chemical family. Mescaline is in a different chemical family.
Okay.
DMT and psilocybin are called are tryptamines, and their ilk are in another class called phenethylamines. So it's actually different. But ayahuasca is unique in terms of its effects. You can't really say it's somewhat like LSD, yes. It's somewhat like mushrooms, yes. But it's really its own.
And there's no language to describe the difference from LSD or from some other experience that somebody out there might relate to?
Well, I think you could say LSD, at least in my past experience, has been, tends to be more of a personal thing, more psychoanalytic, more in a sense about you and about your, you know, your psychology, whatever problems you may have, that sort of thing. Ayahuasca can be that way. There are more transpersonal elements, more archetypical elements. It's much like dreaming, and it's like dreaming while you're awake, in the sense that you experience many archetypal type themes, and I guess that's the best way to describe it. People do use it for self-examination and psychotherapy, but it seems to incorporate. It seems to be, I guess, more of a direct pipeline to the collective unconscious. Many of what
now that's something Terrence said about it.
Right.
That's something Terrence said
right.
about it. All
and
right, Dennis, Doctor, we're at the bottom of the hour.
Sure.
Should I call you Doctor or Dennis or both?
Dennis is fine.
Dennis is fine. All right, stay right there, Dennis. We're at the bottom of the hour. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And don't do any of this. If you want to listen, that's fine, but nobody's encouraging you to do any drugs. Stay natural. You'll be happy.
The drums are going tonight. She hears only whispers. Some quiet conversation. She's coming in 12:30 flights.
My guest is Dennis McKenna, Dr. Dennis McKenna, the brother of the late Terrence McKenna, who's on the show many times with me. And we have had many discussions on this program about drugs, and we're going to touch on many of them tonight. And none of this discussion should be interpreted by anybody out there as an indication that you should go out and do it. This is an examination of what some of this is all about. That's all. Drugs are part of our life. They're very much part of our life. Whether the over-the-counter type, the type you get at the store where it says drugs, or the guy down the street. You know, drugs are part of our society. Actually, a very large part of our society. So dare we talk about them? Absolutely. Once again, Dr. Dennis McKenna. Dennis, welcome back.
Thank you.
How much of the experience of the pharmaceutical, the drugs themselves, crossed into a sort of a metaphysical search? How much of a part of all of this was that?
Well, I think at that time in our lives, it was very much bound up with the metaphysical search. You know, we were so impressed with the effects of synthetic DMT, and so sort of frustrated with the rapidity of the experience. That was the rationale for going to the Amazon to look for this orally active, this very obscure orally active form called Ukuhe, and out Ukuhe, which I returned to the Amazon 10 years later and did part of my doctoral work, turned out not to be that interesting. But in the process of investigating these things, we encountered the mushrooms when we went to La Chorrera for the first time, and eventually ayahuasca. And those are the orally active tryptamine hallucinogens that really have more depth to them.
I'm somewhat curious.
I'm sorry, as
you go down, as you go to the Amazon, and there are you, Terrence and yourself are in the Amazon, you're going to some natives way out in the middle of nowhere. How do you begin to ask them?
Well,
you know, what plants? Take us to the plants who want to have this experience. How do you approach them?
Well, we were very naive at the time. We didn't really know. We had read a few papers from Schulte's work, from the Botanical Museum leaflets that reported this for the first time. We just, you know, we were 20 years old, 20 and 24 years old, respectively. I mean, we figured, you know, the world was our oyster, and we could just go down there and get to it. And as it turned out, that wasn't so far wrong. And there was an amusing incident when we were on the way to La Chorrera, which is the ancestral home of the Witoto, and this area of diffusion where this Ukuhe is most widely used, even though now it's pretty much a dying cultural tradition. But there was a Colombian anthropologist at one of the villages that we passed through, Dr. Collier, and he claimed that, you know, if we went and asked the people for Ukuhe, most would not know what we were talking about because it was a secret that only the shaman knew. And if we chanced to ask a shaman, he would probably kill us for even mentioning it.
Really? They told you that?
Well, he told us that, but he was a little paranoid himself. So as it turned out, it wasn't so bad. And when I actually went back in 1981 as a graduate student to sort of more systematically go about this, I went to a different place. Colombia was difficult to travel in at that point, and I went to Peru to a village called Pucuarquillo, which is just north of the Amazon, downriver from the city of Iquitos, and that is sort of the new home of the Witoto after they were driven out of Colombia during the rust boom. And so I went there and interviewed many people and sampled many collections, and what I found was that, you know, it's a disappearing tradition among these people who have been, you know, very much impacted. And it was like, well, I remember my grandfather knew something about this. My father knew something. I can try and make it. Of course, they didn't speak English or even Spanish. We were working through translators. But that was, you know, that seemed to be the position it held at that time. But we did find one or two older people, older shaman in this group, who really did know how to make the real stuff. And so end up getting samples, bringing them back to the lab, and being able to, well, for my personal reasons, complete the thesis.
How long were you there in instances?
Well, in 1971, when we went down, we weren't really there that long. We went down in January of 71 and came out around the end of April.
That's quite a while.
Right. And in 81, when I went to Peru, I wasn't Pucarquillo the whole time. I was traveling all over of the country because I was also investigating ayahuasca. I was there about 5.5 months.
Oh no, that's quite a while.
That's a while.
Yeah. Did you actually live out with the natives for a while?
Part of the time. But when you're working with ayahuasca in the Amazon, the mestizo populations is really a sort of an urban phenomenon. There are still tribes out in, you know, up the rivers that are using it, but it's become amalgamated into mestizo folk medicine. So it's really on the outskirts of cities like Iquitos and Pucallpa.
How much longer will all of this even be there? In other words, you're saying it's being assimilated, it's disappearing. In another 10 or 20 or 50 years, would you not be able to make that trip with the same results?
It would be difficult. I mean, a lot of these indigenous tribes are definitely in a state of cultural decline. They've been impacted by so many factors, relocation, dislocation, and loss of their cultures. But in mestizo folk medicine, where ayahuasca is commonly used and is kind of the at the center of a whole pharmacopoeia of medicinal plants that these people use, I think that tradition is going to survive, especially now there's so much interest from American tourists. I mean, this whole industry of drug tourism, you know, which I don't necessarily think is entirely a bad thing or a good thing, but it's, in a sense, in a shot in the arm to the traditional people.
You mean there are people that virtually, they're drug tourists? They go down there just to...
People that go down to have these experiences, usually with ayahuasca. The problem is that there's also, you know, any time there's a revival, there's also a lot of charlatans. It's not easy to get to people that really know what they're doing, but you can easily find anybody on the street corners of Iquitos who'd be willing to sell you, you know, something that they call ayahuasca. You couldn't be sure that that's what it is, but it's a mixed bag. But I think, you know, one of the positive things about it is that some of these people are sincere and they are rediscovering their own traditions. I mean, I don't think ayahuasca is going to go away very soon. And in fact, you know, there are indications that it may be spreading, and that, you know, again, that has negative and positive aspects about it.
Let's talk a little bit.
I would like to say I appreciate that you sort of put in that caveat there at the end of the hour. I'm not on this program to advocate that anyone should do
drugs,
any
yeah.
of these things. I think that they should be investigated. I disagree with the whole strategy of the war on drugs. I think that's very sighted, and I think that people should have personal choice to form relationships with plants, which is basically what this is about.
I do have a lot of trouble with the war on drugs.
Right.
Particularly the way it's being orchestrated disproportionately with regard to marijuana, for example.
Well, it doesn't... it simply doesn't work. I think the thing to do, you know, a better approach is to enable people to make informed choices. When I say form relationships with plants, I use that term deliberately because I think when you choose to use a drug of any sort, you're choosing to have a relationship with that substance.
That's
and
sure.
Just as you should be careful in choosing your friends and choosing the people you want to hang out with, you should be careful and make informed choices in terms of the substances you put into your body, and particularly with the psychedelics, the circumstances, the set and setting that Leary talked about
sure.
is so important for the effects. And that is why shamanism is really the model. These people have been working with these substances for thousands of years. And, you know, if we're going to develop models, whether psychotherapeutic or shamanic, but you need to, in order to use these substances safely and, you know, in a way that has benefits, and I believe they can be used safely and they can be beneficial, but the context is so important. And this is the problem, that in this culture we lack that context. We lack that traditional context.
Are there laws against these drugs now in America?
Which drugs?
Well, DMT.
DMT is a controlled substance, definitely.
All right.
When it comes to plants that contain DMT, of which many, many do, because DMT is a very simple compound and very widespread in nature, the situation is much murkier. It's not clear. In fact, the plants themselves, as far as anyone knows, are not illegal. But then they contain a controlled substance, DMT. Our own brain contains DMT. So this is creating some legal conundrums right now. How can you ban all plants containing DMT without essentially criminalizing all of nature? You know, DMT has been detected in over 150 species of plants, and that's only because somebody's bothered to look. My personal belief is it's probably found in thousands, if not tens of thousands, of plant genera.
Doctor, quick question for you. Hallucinogens, the entire family, as a whole, are they addictive, physically addictive, in your opinion?
No, they're not. They're not physically addictive. They don't work on that part of the brain that leads to addiction, which substances can, for instance, have a completely different neurochemistry, neuropharmacology, and they work on the parts of the brain that have to do with our pleasure sensations. And so they tend to create a craving. If anything, the hallucinogens are anti-addictive, or you're certainly, you know...
Some people would take it and say, I'm not doing that again.
Exactly. You sort of have to get your courage up to
yes.
keep doing it.
Yes,
So, yeah, they're definitely not addictive in the physiological sense or the psychological sense.
They're diminishing returns as one continues to use it.
Again, I think that depends on the substance that one is using, and it depends on the context in which you use it. If you use it for recreational purposes or without any real intent, I mean, in taking ayahuasca, they always emphasize that it's important to have an intent, then I think after a while there are diminishing returns because, you know, you have no framework in which to, in which to understand it. On the other hand, if you're working in a context, whether it's something that you create, sort of your self-referential context for learning, or whether it's a more traditional shamanic type context, then I think there are anything but diminishing returns. I mean, that's the thing, particularly with substances like ayahuasca. If you know, people shouldn't get involved with it without knowing that it's really a life's work. It's a path. It's not an instant. It's not a fast track to enlightenment or anything like that. It's like any other discipline. And to be involved with ayahuasca or many of these substances, really, what I call the classical hallucinogens, it's a discipline. And people should approach it that way.
All right. Back to the war on drugs for just a second. Do you delineate in your own mind the difference between the hallucinogens and cocaine, for example? We've got, my God, over 2 million people in jail in America right now for various drug violations. Very few of them, no doubt, relating to DMT or any other class of hallucinogens. Some,
right.
But the majority, cocaine and heroin and
right.
that sort of class of drugs.
Right, right. Well, again, you know, where I think a differentiation could be made that might be useful and might actually help clarify some of the issues on the war on drugs are to make a distinction between plants and compounds. If you look at the way coca is used in Peru among the indigenous peoples, or even opium as a plant substance, it's much less harmful.
Yeah, they chew it.
Much more difficult to become addicted or abused. And I think if the drug warriors were to say, we'll make a distinction between plants and drugs. We will focus on substances that are extracted, purified, or synthesized. Plants, we're not so interested in. 90% drug problem would go away if they would just, say, we're not going, primarily cannabis would drop out of the debate.
Sure.
Well, it's an herb, and we're not that concerned with
it. Well, what would happen if they brought coca plants, raw coca plants, to America and began selling them on the street or in a store, as they are sold in South America and used and chewed? Would it be an instant hit, or would it be sort of, hey, what's the big deal?
Hey, what's the big deal? I don't think most people would bother with it because, because it is no big deal. I mean, coca is traditionally used, is about as harmful as green tea. There have been studies that show that coca, among the people who live and depend on it, it's an appetite suppressant. It also supplies minerals and vitamins that they don't ordinarily get in their diet. I mean, chewing abuse is, it's about as bad a habit as drinking coffee.
So I was going to say, is it like coffee?
Yeah, it's somewhat like that, a mild...
So then you think for the purposes of settling this damned war, this godforsaken war, we could delineate between plants and purified substance from plants?
Well, I think that that would, yes, I think that that would be a step in the right direction. And if the government were to say, we're going to focus our efforts on people that are extracting or synthesizing or making these pure substances, which are much more easily abused and inherently more dangerous because they're more potent, I think that that would be a step in the right direction. I don't expect it to happen because I personally, I don't think personally that the war on drugs is particularly about protecting people from drugs. If that were the case, then all the focus would be on tobacco, which is an herb. It also kills 400,000 people a year in this country, as opposed to all other drugs of abuse, which kill maybe 20,000 people a year.
Absolutely. All right.
So, here
we are at the top of the hour already. Time really flies. You can find out. So, Dr. McKenna, hold on. We'll get back to you after the news at the top of the hour. We're talking about drugs, all kinds of drugs, with Dr. Dennis McKenna. I'm Art Bell.
The world was on fire and no one could save me but you. Strange world desire will make foolish people lose. I never dreamed that I'd meet somebody.
Guest is Dr. Dennis McKenna, and we are talking about drugs. We're talking about plants, and we're talking about drugs, and we're talking about the drug war, and we're talking about all kinds of strange things and interesting things. So I suggest you stay right where you are, because we have only just begun. Once again, here is Dr. Dennis McKenna. Dennis, welcome back.
Thank you.
I have a question for you that you cannot... You certainly don't have to answer. You can consider it, not answer it. I spoke with Dr. Timothy Leary before he passed away briefly and had set up an interview, and, of course, there wasn't enough life left, and we never made it.
Uh-huh.
Although he was very comfortable to the very end. He had a big cylinder next to him. It's a long story. Anyway, when I interviewed Terrence, I asked Terrence something that I had heard about Dr. Leary, and that was that out there somewhere, buried or secreted away in a place that might still be found, it is said, and has been said for years, there are 20,000 hits of Blue Sandoz, LSD.
Uh-huh.
And Terrence chuckled a little and didn't exactly say he knew where they were, but he didn't say he didn't know where they were.
He didn't know where they were.
You don't think he knew?
Of course not.
Well,
I think that's an urban myth.
An urban legend? You really think so?
I do.
You don't think Timothy socked him away somewhere, huh?
Well, I don't know. Maybe he did.
Yeah, maybe he did, right.
Okay. I hope they're cold anyway, or they won't be much good.
Well, that's true, isn't it? All right, so urban legend. Okay. Somebody writes, and I've got a screen I can look at, this computer screen, and people can send what's called a fast blast and ask questions. Mm-hmm. Somebody writes and says, would you ask Dr. McKenna, please, if the spraying of defoliant in South America, which we are doing now due to the, you know, the whole drug war thing, is
right.
affecting these plants in the areas that you talked about?
Well, yes. It's certainly, I mean, it's affecting everything in the areas that we're talking about. I actually... Dr. Mark Plotkin, who is an ethnobotanist that many of you may know about, he's very well known as the author of Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, among other things, but he is working down there with his nonprofit group called the Amazon Conservation Team,
mm-hmm.
and he has been doing quite a bit of work in southern Colombia and has seen firsthand the impact of this defoliation. It's not only, I mean, the problem is that it's very hard to target the defoliant only on the coca fields. It also drifts over the crops that these people depend on for their food and the villages where the people live. And anyone can go down there and see that, you know, the impact is tremendous. I mean, children with terrible skin diseases and, you know, it's definitely impacting those people. And it's well, you know, it's outrageous. It basically amounts to international criminal behavior on the part of the United States, in my opinion. There's got to be a better way to deal with this problem than toxifying the environment.
Again, that's a war against the plants. It's not a war against the people that are extracting and purifying.
Well, yeah. It's a war. It's an attempt to exterminate the plants, which is in itself a bad idea. But the problem is it also impacts, I mean, these plants are growing where these people live. And, you know, they also grow their crops in the same or adjacent fields. So it gets in their food supply. It gets on the people themselves directly. You know, this is just one of the consequences of this misguided policy.
Mm-hmm. All right, a little about DMT and drugs like it. I played a song just for fun before you came on, "Journey to the Center of the Mind," and at one part of that song it says, "But be careful," referring to the journey, "you might not come back."
Mm-hmm.
Now, with LSD, there were some people that essentially didn't come back.
Right.
And I've always wondered, and I'd like your opinion, do you think that these are people who were predisposed to psychological difficulties in the first place, or that the of whatever drug we're talking about here was the primary cause of...
No, I think that in most cases, the incidences of people who, quote-unquote, don't come back are extremely low, for one thing. And I think that in most cases, you can say that there were previous psychological problems and that the drugs, the LSD or whatever, was basically a catalyst, that they were at risk, of psychosis, anyway.
The problem, of course, is that these are the very people on the street level that are most likely to do something like that.
Well, again, this comes back to the whole issue. Number one, these are not for everyone. And number two, you have to pay attention to set and setting. The context is so important because, again, you know, in the shamanic context, in the use of ayahuasca, for example, in Peru, when people do get into psychological difficulties. They can have panic reactions or anxiety. Many people often, become convinced that they're either dying or that they're not going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
but the shaman, you know, has a bag of tricks, essentially, and is able to apply some of those tricks simply, I mean, very simple things, such as singing one of these hikaros, one of these magical songs, or blowing tobacco smoke over the person, or otherwise, you know, do things to calm them down and kind of get them back on a stable footing. That's why it's very important to, you know, have a structured context, some sort of ritual context. And, you know, generally, it helps if there's a person, in the case, in this case, the shaman, you know, that people have confidence in, that they sort of feel that this person is watching over them, or this group of persons. That's one of the dangers with the, you know, with the drug tourism. Not all shamans are that experienced. Some, and some you can't always trust. And so you sort of have to, you know, it's better if you do this in a situation where you feel safe and you feel like the people that you're with, you know, really are looking after you and not just there to take your money. And that's the thing. I mean, I think in the context of our society, if these psychedelics, which I really, you know, you have to place them in a category apart from all of these other substances, which are more recreational, but the psychedelics are more of a spiritual or experiential thing. But I think if these things are ever going to be used, you know, in our culture, we have to develop some kind of models, some kind of context. It may not be traditional shamanism. We can't really integrate that into our culture. No. But we can take some of the elements and combine it with elements of psychotherapy, for example.
Well, let's try this angle. Doctor, what would you say would be the psychological or metaphysical benefits or gains that a person might reasonably expect to take away from the experience?
Well, it's hard to say because the experience is as individual as the person, and a lot of it depends on what your expectations are. Again, getting back to this issue of intent. You know, some people may take it, and in the case of ayahuasca, it's generally emphasized that it's important to have an expectation to an intent. People may take it to have insights about their relationships, for example, or psychological problems, you know, maybe depression or you know, sleep difficulties or even physical illnesses. People take ayahuasca, you know, to have insights about their physical state of health. Other people may take it to solve problems, you know, things that they're working on, intellectual things or, you know, it's taken for all these purposes.
So then it allows intense physical self-examination or intellectual self-examination?
It allows for both, yes, physical and intellectual self-examination. I think that ayahuasca is unique. While the hallucinogens themselves stand apart from all of these other substances as unique, I think that ayahuasca is, again, unique among that group because I think that there is much more to its activity than just the psychological experience. It's not that you take it, experience, and that then it's over. It continues to work afterwards, more than other hallucinogens. There's a lot of processing, both mental and physical, that goes on subsequent to the experience.
Maybe you could comment on this for me. There are many scientists investigating near-death experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very interesting things produced by near-death experiences, associations with white light, relatives that have passed away, examination of one's own life, you know, flashing by you, that sort of thing. Is there a relationship of the pharmacology that occurs in the brain between any of these drugs and what might occur during a near-death experience, do you suppose?
Yes, I think there probably is. I think that these two territories interface with each other or share a common border. I mean, it is known, for example, that DMT and its close relative, 5-methoxy-DMT, are both neurochemicals. They both occur in the normal human brain. We're not sure what their functions are. People have suggested, my colleague Jace Calloway, a scientist in Finland, who has worked on these issues, suggests that maybe endogenous, that is internally occurring DMT, has to do with the modulation of dream states. And he's come up with a very plausible and testable theory that could show that maybe this is the physiological function of DMT. Other experiments have shown that in stress situations, in states of extreme stress, and I think we can put death in that category.
Yeah, absolutely.
The levels of DMT in your circulation, in your spinal fluid, for example, and presumably in your brain, are elevated markedly. Hmm. So it's possible that in the dying state, the brain is actually programmed to turn these things out and modulate the experience, which is not to say that, you know, it doesn't reduce it to a DMT experience. I think a DMT, you know, is probably an element of the process of dying and probably of the process of being born as well.
Wow. That was a better question than I thought it was. That's really interesting. So then one might...
Well, I believe one of your guests was Dr. Rick Strassman on your program recently, or was that another?
It may have been another host.
Oh, he is a researcher, a colleague of mine and others in this field, and he was one of the first researchers to do some FDA-approved research on DMT at the University of New Mexico a few years ago. He was using synthetic DMT, administering it by injection. But he has recently written a book on his research called DMT, The Spirit Molecule. And it's very interesting. He has some very interesting and provocative things to say in that book about the possible functions of DMT. For example, he suggests that at the 49th day of conception, which is in many traditions thought to be the moment that the soul enters the body,
right,
that the pineal gland, which is the source of one source, the primary source of these endogenous tryptamines, there is a spike in its synthesis of DMT. I'm not sure what the basis of his statement is, but I think people with an interest in DMT should pick this book up. It's quite interesting. I'm just in the middle of it.
Fascinating. On the 49th day, when some say the soul is inculcated,
mm-hmm,
there is a definite a spike in the DMT, or
produced in the brain.
In the brain? Wow.
That's right.
Wow.
This is what he says. I haven't seen the paper for it, but this is what he says.
Oh, my. That really is very provocative.
So it's not unreasonable to expect that at death something similar would go on. And generally, you know, in states of extreme stress or psychological stress, you know, it's not unreasonable to think that that may trigger the release of DMT, which is actually released into the circulation as much as in the brain. Besides the brain, the organ in the body that synthesizes DMT is the adrenal glands, which are very much involved with the stress response.
All right. Again, a question that you are fully, you're just welcome to not answer it, but I you know, while you've... certainly concentrated on the science side of all this, it's hard to believe that back through the 60s and through the trips to the Amazon and all the time you spent with Terrence, that you would not have, that you stayed a pure academic, that you would not have experienced all of this. So can we get that out of the way?
Well, yes, I have, and I think that's clear to everybody that knows our work. Yes, I mean, I have approached it from a scientific standpoint, but, you know, you can't become a lens grinder or a telescope maker without occasionally looking through the telescope. I
mean, right.
This is the analogy.
So, was the experience for you, would you describe it in as profound a manner as Terence did, or was it for you a different experience?
Which experience?
Well, DMT. We'll stick to DMT. Yeah, sure.
Well, yeah, it was pretty profound. I mean, it is one of the most reliably profound experiences in the smoked form, because it is so overwhelming. In the orally active forms, it's sometimes extremely profound and sometimes not so profound. And again, it sort of depends on the circumstances. And sometimes you get a leg up, and sometimes you don't. In these orally active forms. But generally, I prefer. I think that the orally active forms are probably the way. If nature meant for man to take DMT, it probably should have been in an orally active form, potentiated by one of these MAO inhibitors.
Well, you know what? That's a really good question all by itself.
Compatible with physiology.
Doctor, that's a good question all by itself. Do you think that God or nature, however you want to phrase it, intended for man to make use of these plants and substances as has been done? Do you think it was intended that way? After all, they are here.
Well, exactly. They are here. I'm a little uncomfortable with the idea that nature intended it. I think that, we are part of nature, and we have always had a relationship with plants. I mean, I think that is the context in which you have to understand, the use of all of these psychoactive plants. It's part of a much vaster web of interaction that we have with the plant kingdom. All of these herbal medicines that people are interested in, the whole interest in natural healing and medicinal plants and so on, really an attempt, I think, on the part of an alienated, urbanized culture to get back to nature, to literally rediscover their roots. And the psychoactive plants, are within this context. I don't think there is somebody out there directing things. I mean, it's not like nature is conscious or God is telling us to take these plants. It's that in the process of evolving on this planet as part of the biosphere, we have co-evolved with these plants and with these substances.
On the other hand, there were the Ten Commandments, and he didn't tell us not to take them.
He didn't tell us.
No. Doctor, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back from the high desert. I'm Art Bell. My guest is Dr. Dennis McKenna. Now to Dr. Dennis McKenna, and we were talking about plants and the fact that they were here, and I said, well, no commandments against interacting with the plants, or as you pointed out earlier, having a relationship with them. It's co-evolution. The plants have been here probably before the walking things, but we're both here, and they're here to be used or looked at or admired or perhaps chewed on, or I don't know. What do you think is intended for human beings and plants?
Well, again, you keep using this word intention. I don't think anybody is running the show. I think that this is sort of an organic process that's going forward, evolutionarily. The thing you have to understand about plants is that they're very different than animals. That seems like an obvious statement, but the way that they interact with the world and experience the world is very different than we do. One famous botanist made the statements that plants have substituted biosynthesis for behavior. Mm-hmm. Now, what he meant by that is that plants, because they can photosynthesize, they make their own food, and as a result, they don't have to go foraging for food because they can make it in sunlight and carbon dioxide and water. One of the consequences of that is that they make a vast variety of chemical compounds. They are virtuoso chemists. And in the same way that animals interact with their environment through behavior, through the famous flea or fight reaction, sure, these sorts of things, plants interact with their environment through chemistry. And they communicate with other organisms in their environment, bacteria in the soil, fungi in the soil, other plants, insects, birds, other animals that may feed on them, and human beings through these chemical messengers, through these molecular messengers. And the molecular messengers, speak in a, figurative sense, they speak to organisms on many levels. They happen to also make chemical messengers that resemble our own neurotransmitters. And, that's where it gets interesting for us,
yes,
for this particular topic, because then you're talking about that literally talk to you. And, they don't say anything, but they, when you ingest them, their neurotransmitter-like chemicals interact with your neurotransmitter systems. And you get very interesting, you get some very interesting results. And I think in some sense you are seeing the world kind of the way they see it. I mean, I don't say that they use these neurotransmitters for perception, but this process of chemically mediated coevolution between plants and humans and all organisms, is a concept that I think needs to be explored. There is a field of science called chemical ecology, which is basically, this is the territory we're in here, the way that chemical systems are used to mediate relationships between organisms. And, it's a two-way street. The plants, we largely value plants, if you think about it, for the chemical compounds they contain, whether they be nutrients or, cellulose, which are fibers that go into textiles,
yes,
or medicinal compounds that we may use, or these more neuroactive compounds.
As you said in the beginning, nutrition, and again, then, I proffer the word intended, because whether it's a plant or an animal, these are all things that co-evolved with us, and even the biblical scholars will say that the plants and the animals were put here for our use. So you can take that or not, but it does seem like a reasonable word to me.
Well, if it's intended, I guess the question is, by whom was it intended?
I'll have a conversation about that if you want.
Right. I mean, is it God that's running the show, or is it ohm-headed beings in geosynchronous orbit, or is it Gaia? I mean, I'm more comfortable with the Gaia notion that the whole biosphere is in some sense an organism. You can think of the,
yes,
the entire biosphere. I mean, it's really a mega organism or a super organism. And just as in a cell in the body, all of the processes of the cell between, say, what's going on in the nucleus and what's going on in the cytoplasm and on the membrane, that's all controlled and coordinated through chemical messengers that are shuttling back and forth from the membrane to the cytoplasm to the nucleus and so on. The same thing is going on in the biosphere. The biosphere is permeated with chemical messengers.
Absolutely.
And many of them are made by plants. And plants are very good at it. I mean, they use these molecular messengers to establish relationships with all sorts of organisms in the environment.
Well, that makes a war.
Insects, for example. Insects are probably the primary example.
Okay.
Plants depend on insects for their pollination in many cases. And the insects, of course, get benefits from the plant in the form of nectar and pollen, which they collect as food sources. So it's a symbiosis, this notion of a symbiotic relationship, which has been very extensively studied between plants and insects, not so extensively studied between plants and humans, but that's the key term, I think, that you have to you have to come at it from that angle. What we're looking at here is a plant-human symbiosis that has impacts on the plants and impacts on us.
So then a war on plants is really screwing with Mother Nature.
Well, it's a really misguided idea. I mean, what gives us? We're only one species in the biosphere. What gives us the right to, you know, decree that some other species, because it happens to be a plant that produces a chemical that, our society has not been able to come to terms with, do we then have the right to decree that, this particular can be exterminated from the face of the earth? I don't think so. I mean, if we were talking about an ethnic group of humans, this wouldn't be tolerated.
Okay, then instead of bearing in mind the fact that we cannot come to terms with it, instead of going to war against it, how do we come to terms with it?
How do we come to terms with it? Well, for one thing, again, going back to making a distinction between plants and chemicals, I think that's part of the thing. And you say, okay, if you want to grow marijuana in your backyard, if you want to grow mushrooms, if you want to grow opium even, you know, we don't care. Whatever you do as a gardener is not of concern to us. We're going to focus on the harder drugs, the drugs where there have to be infrastructures of creation and distribution, and you have to have, you know, that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect of it is simply education. I think you have to give people the tools to make informed choices about, number one, whether to use drugs. Number two, if the answer to number one is, yes, I want to use drugs, the second question is, which drugs are you going to use?
Mm-hmm.
And the third question is, how are you going to use them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is the problem with the war on drugs and the whole dialogue is there's this big, scary category called drugs, you know, that all things are put into. Well, there are drugs and there are drugs. There are many different types of drugs. And it seems that the drug warriors have set up this big, you know, scary bugaboo called drugs, but of course they don't include in that, you know, the drugs that they happen to favor, which are, you know, tobacco, alcohol. These things are also drugs.
Sure they are.
So I think we have to have a more rational dialogue about the subject, and we have to stop scaring people and try to give them, you know, the tools to make informed decisions. It all comes down to education. And it's like saying, well, you know, you don't have to use drugs to have a full life and to have a completely fulfilled life. You know, if you make that choice, fine. If you do choose to use substances, be careful about which relationships you form with these substances and the circumstances under which you use them. It's no different than forming relationships with people, you know. And Andrew Wilde said all this years ago in his book, The Natural Mind. I mean, nobody listened then. Nobody's listening now. But that is the solution, you know. Nobody wants their kids to go out and get messed up with drugs, but the key thing is, if you promulgate what is essentially misinformation, I mean, let's not put too fine a point on it, let's call it lies, kids are not stupid, they're going to find out, and then, you know, they will disregard what you say. So they say, well, you know, you lied about marijuana, so you must be lying about heroin.
Been saying that for years.
And they've been saying that for years.
Yeah, nothing
Why
makes
not
me angrier.
Have a reasonable debate?
I know. Nothing through the years has made me angrier than the lies that are told about marijuana, because, of course, they then cause the young people to just go right on up the chain, and before you know it, The cops put them in the back of a car with crack cocaine, and then off they go, part of the system, in jail.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the laws that are designed to control the drug problem are having a worse impact than the problem itself.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jimmy Carter said this. If that's the case, then we need to rethink this whole dialogue. And in terms of the psychedelics, I think that, you know, they do need to be used in a ritual context or in a fairly structured context, and the use of guides or more experienced people who, you know, can kind of structure the experience, much as it goes on in shamanism. And shamanism is really the model. I don't think we can, you know, I don't think we can reproduce it, but I think we can take a few pages from that book and try and implement it. And I can envision, you know, in a more rational society, a situation where there would be a place or there would be a center where one could go and have these experiences, and it would be legal, and it would be, you know, it would be beneficial to people.
We are not now that rational, nor are we even close.
No.
How far in the future can just sort of stand back and observe our progression socially? How far in the future do you envision something like this might be a reality?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it's really very hard to say, because I don't see. I mean, I think that the people, as almost always, the people are way out in front of their government on this issue. You know, most people feel that marijuana, that medical marijuana, for example, should be available to people that need it, to people that have diseases or chronic problems that this could help. I think most people feel that rather than being put in jail, people should be given access to treatments, you know, as their first option. There have been propositions passed in California to this effect and a couple of other states. So the people have a much more reasonable approach to the problem than the government does. The problem is the government tends to be slow to change, you know, there's also a vested interest in keeping things the way they are.
Well, for example, you mentioned Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
A lot of people thought that when Jimmy Carter became president, there'd probably be a move to legalize marijuana. Well, lo and behold, didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
Then people thought, well, next time we get a Democrat in office, it'll happen then. Lo and behold, didn't happen.
Right. Because, again, I think this is a function of the fact that it's very hard for politicians to come out on this issue. You know, even if they do feel that it's misguided, anytime you make a statement that is, you know, in the least perceived as being pro-drug, you're vilified.
I know.
You know, this is the problem. And politicians as a group are not a particularly
brave
That's right. bunch of people. I mean, their decisions are based on, you know, what they think is going to get them reelected. And there is such a vocal anti-drug majority, or minority, actually. I think it is a minority, but they're very vocal. And so, you know, if you say, well, maybe we should take a different approach, then immediately they're pounced upon.
Well,
and
doctor,
conversation is possible.
Doctor, I lived in a state where there was a rational moment. I lived in Alaska when the Alaskan Supreme Court struck down the laws against marijuana, and it became legal to have to grow your own plants and to have, I can't remember, an ounce or two for your own personal use.
Uh-huh.
And it was a great success for a while in Alaska. But then all of a sudden from Washington, D.C., they came rushing in and all conversations stopped. The drug war was in full force, and Alaska reversed it all. So,
well, again, this is the irony. You know, the current administration and the you know, the position of the conservatives traditionally is get government off people's back. And what I actually think they mean is get the government off corporations' backs. You know, put, I mean, when it comes to what we do in our bedrooms or what we put in our bodies or how we handle our reproductive choices, you know, these regimes are very, you know, very much totalitarian. They want to control that kind of behavior. They think it's very much their business. And, you know, this is where the conflict is.
I take it you would consider yourself politically a libertarian.
I'm not a libertarian. I mean, I about the only thing I agree with the libertarian agenda is the notion that these substances should be regulated in a sane way. No, I think government has a place in people's lives. I'm basically a liberal,
yes.
I guess. I think government should be concentrating on helping people and, you know, making people's lives better. If you pay taxes, why not get some benefit from it? What bothers me is that my taxes go for, you know, the war in Colombia, which is not being talked about in the media and is a war, you know, or the missile defense system, you know, this completely absurd technological boondoggle that most of the experts say will never work. I mean, these are the things that I would rather not have my taxes spent on.
Well, I agree with you completely, although your view with regard to substances is very libertarian. And
yeah.
And you say otherwise you're a liberal, which would generally mean to a lot of people that you want government involved in a lot of areas.
But not in my personal life. I don't want them telling me, you know, I want them to be concerned with the public health aspects of drug use and all of these other things, but I don't really want them to say, you know, if you smoke this herb or if you drink this plant, you're going to jail. And I think, you know, it's just absurd. I'd rather have them giving, you know, a more intelligent level of support to this sort of thing.
All right. You know, I would very much like to allow some of the audience after the break to ask you questions, if you're up for that.
Sure.
Are you? Okay, good. Stay right there, then. My guest is Dr. Dennis McKenna, the brother of the late Terrence McKenna, who appeared on the show many, many times. And they're both obviously brilliant minds. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM, screaming through the night like a freight train. Glad to have you along as a passenger. Sit down, stick around.